We really appreciate you joining us and listening to the Web Talk Guys show. And my name is Rob Greenlee.
And I'm Dana, and we've been here every week to give you a peek inside the future of the internet for 4 years now, Rob. I mean, our anniversary is coming up. February 99, we started on KLAY, which is a radio station up here in Seattle, Tacoma, 1180 AM. And we're proud to be on CNET Radio in San Francisco and, of course, all over the place on the web, but primarily webtalkguys.com.
You can hear the Web Talk Guys show from windowsmedia.com in the radio tuner under Talk Radio and in the business section, and also the Mazingo Network. And you can go there and download and listen via your pocket PC. So go visit our front page and sign up for Mazingo and our Web Talk Guy email newsletter to get all of the inside scoops into what's coming on the Web Talk Guy show.
We would constantly hear from you, our beloved listeners and subscribers to our newsletter. It's interesting to know that your number one show topic that you tell us you want to hear about is streaming media, near and dear to our hearts. So we're going to dedicate the entire show today to a conversation with both the streaming magazine editor and the MPEG 4 Industry Forum president.
Streaming media's three hot E's are growing. We will be speaking with streaming magazine editor Doug Wiley about why those three E's are so hot and what they are. And also, we're going to find out why companies are increasingly turning to streaming media, both to save money and to improve processes.
I like to point to news and sports as two really great, compelling sources of content that don't have copyright issues. And if you have the ability to stream the audio signal of a baseball game from the East Coast while you're sitting in your office and check out a couple of scores while you're at it, that is stunningly compelling.
Later in the show, we're talking MPEG-4. MPEG-4 video and audio is a standard developed by the Moving Picture Experts Group. That's MPEG. That's what MPEG stands for. And they're the committee that also developed the Emmy Award-winning standards known as MPEG-1 and MPEG-2. These are the standards that made interactive CD-ROMs back in the day and digital television now. And we're hoping it will become sort of a streaming media standard format that the industry so needs to mature. Rob Coonan, who's president of the MPEG-4 Industry Forum, joins us on Web Talk Guys via our streaming media show. And the interview will be done by the streaming media show's host, Dan Rayburn.
We are trying to do all the things that are necessary to get MPEG-4 adopted. Telling people what MPEG-4 is crucially important. Licensing is the major hurdle, so we spent a lot of time discussing the issues for MPEG-4. Well, we don't want to deal with licensing ourselves. That is not our task, but we did want to do the things that were necessary to break the logjam.
All that streaming stuff is ahead. Don't miss the stream here on Web Talk Guys Radio.
Some news from around the net this week. Hotbots Reborn and Rob's domain name modification soapbox this week. Rob?
The search engine Hotbot has been reborn. The Terrell Lycos people have been saying for a long time that they were going to upgrade and improve the Hotbot search engine, and they have. And they've got some terrific new tools up there. They've simplified it. Right on their front page, they have a link that you can click on to search alltheweb.com, Google, the Tomi search engine, and Teoma, those are all the hot search engines right now. So you can go to one place and do one query and go get results right from those search engines.
Any of you guys went to visit Web Talk Guys this past week? There was a few days we were down. Why is that, Rob? And I think this is time for your soapbox.
Yeah, we definitely learned a few things by having our server moved to a new co-location facility. And I think that the big thing is that we came to the conclusion that we don't want to ever use VeriSign for our domain name hosting.
Why is that? And VeriSign, please don't sue Rob.
Well, VeriSign is basically the company that acquired Network Solutions. Network Solutions has been the major registrar on the web for millions of websites.
I was going to say years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But what we basically found is that their user interface is too confusing, mm-hmm. and is too difficult to understand what to do, and came to the conclusion that to do any kind of modifications was problematic and could cause problems. So,
well, and I've had incidences where they charge my credit card over and over again for a domain purchase.
And I also think that it takes too long right now for a domain name to switch servers. I mean, it can take up to 72 hours to actually transfer a domain from one server host to another. And I frankly think that's unreasonable. One of the solutions that could be implemented would be to have all DNS servers out there pick up updated DNS information from the master DNS servers every 24 hours instead of some of them picking up every other day or every 2 or 3 days or something like that. It could because that really prolongs the propagation that exists out there for a website to get back up again.
So what you're calling for is for ICANN to step in and make some decisions, perhaps, and standardize that method.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the ICANN organization can certainly help with that, but I think that the industry itself, you know, the network solutions, the VeriSigns, the registers, they need to put political pressure, I think, on the governing bodies to make some changes to that process, because what we went through, I think, is unreasonable, and it keeps sites down.
If your site doesn't come up when people come to you and you're a business, it looks like you're out of business. That's scary.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big penalty right now to move your website from one host provider to another, where it can be down for 3 or 4 days. I mean, a lot of companies won't move it just for that reason alone. And I think that's an unfair situation, and I think it keeps the market from being as competitive as it could be and keep costs down and keep providers honest, basically.
Well, that wasn't too painful, that
soapbox.
No,
I don't think so. Now, stay connected for a special conversation with streaming magazine editor Doug Wiley. This is WebTalk Guys Radio.
The WebTalk Guys are thrilled to be your radio hosts, but we'd also be thrilled to host your website, too. The WebTalk Guys website hosting service combines a high-speed, dedicated internet connection and the marketing power of a link from the show's website to help you. We offer all the standard hosting stuff for a very low, limited-time hosting price of only $10 a month for the first 3 months. To learn more, go to WebTalkGuys.com and click on Web Services or email info@WebTalkGuys.com. You can reach us by calling area code 253-640-0164. WebTalk Guys, not just your radio hosts, but also your total hosting solution.
You are listening to the WebTalk Guys.
You're listening to the WebTalk Guys radio show, and I'm Rob Greenley.
And I'm Dana. Streaming media is slowly becoming a hot topic once again, thank goodness, as the internet and web users are becoming inclined to pay for content online, and as companies find a way to save money and to improve their processes.
To actually give us the streaming media industry level view is streaming magazine editor Doug Wiley, and he's also going to tell us why enterprise, education, and entertainment are becoming so hot. And he's also going to tell us why companies are increasingly turning to streaming media for all sorts of solutions. Doug, welcome to the show.
Rob, good talking with you.
You guys have just published your buyer's guide. Why don't you tell us a bit about what's in it?
Well, the 2003 buyer's guide is essentially what it amounts to being is a reboot of the industry. We've had a rough couple of months here, as everyone is pretty much aware, and some companies have gone by the wayside. Some companies have really increased their market position. And what we wanted to do was to help to inform buying executives, the decision makers in the corporate environment, not only what companies are out there and what those companies offer, but the streaming industry as a whole, what it is, what value it provides, and what are the potential upsides for, say, an enterprise or for someone in the entertainment space. Mm-hmm. And so what we've done was, you know, we've basically tried to compile what amounts to being a directory and some instructional copy and content that'll help, you know, those decision makers in 2003, because we believe in 2003, really, we're going to start seeing the industry doing a lot better than obviously that it did last year, but even more so, really increasing its position in the corporate environment and in the entertainment environment, of course, in the distance learning and education.
How would a person actually get a hold of this buyer's guide?
Well, the easiest way to do that is to go to the website, streamingmagazine.com, and there is an icon on which you can click to purchase it. If you're an international listener, I believe it's an additional, I think, $5. So it's $9.99 mm-hmm. with delivery already and shipping paid, and then it's $15.99 or $15.95 for an international purchaser. And we hope that there are a lot of folks throughout the entire globe who are looking at this, because streaming, the whole idea about it is that we can shrink the size of the world in the way in which we communicate by leveraging some of the streaming assets that you'll see in the buyer's guide, the services and the software and the hardware companies that we've got.
And in fact, just like you mentioned, there's a lot of countries other than the United States that really hold dear streaming media, and Australia is one of them. I mean, are you aware of other countries that use streaming media extensively?
Absolutely. Actually, in places like Japan, in Hong Kong, the development is increasing pretty nicely. Oh, throughout Europe, where you have the wireless environment further advanced than it is here in the United States, there's a lot of talk about streaming to wireless devices. There are some new telephones that are capable of receiving really good quality stream signal.
Doug, why don't you tell us a bit about Streaming Magazine and also tell us a little bit about the actual site that you guys have and how it supports your magazine.
Yeah, terrific. topic, I'd be happy. The website, streamingmagazine.com, receives tens of thousands of viewers. It's a great way for me to get my news, actually, because there's a place where companies can submit their press releases directly to me, and then I can call them back and follow up on that. So it is really a two-way conduit. The website itself contains, you know, up-to-the-day news and information. We have some of our features from the magazine itself. The magazine is published by Streamline Publishing, which is based in Florida, West Palm Beach, Florida. They also publish Radio Inc. The magazine was launched in May of 2000. It remains the only magazine strictly focused on streaming media and the discussion of what streaming can and now does do. Our vision is basically to explain the industry and the technology in an easy-to-understand way and provide the in-depth coverage that the companies in the space really deserve so that they can get their stories out there so that when they go out and they start talking to potential customers, those customers can have an idea in the back of their minds, those CEOs and CTOs and CFOs, and more importantly, have an idea in their mind of what investment they're actually making.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an informative industry trade magazine that's really outwardly focused, not on the reporting to the streaming companies, but streaming reporting about the streaming companies to the rest of the world.
Would you say that that's the reason that, Stream Magazine is still around when a lot of other streaming publications have gone away?
I think that there are probably a couple of reasons why we're still around. I like to think that the primary reason is the fact we have a fantastic staff. Our publisher, Eric Rhodes, who is fully committed to helping to grow the industry overall, to helping to make sure that there is a publication focused on the industry. In addition to that, we have, I think, a great way of telling the story, trying to take a fairly complicated series of technologies, whether it be hardware, software, or services, or a combination of the three, and explain them in not so much a facile way, but in a way in which an executive has nothing to do with technology whatsoever. For example, someone, say, for example, Michael Moore at Garena, who's implemented streaming technology for their enterprise. The point is that that executive had something in their pocket when they started going to the CFO and saying, this is something I think we need to spend some money on. Here's the ROI,
mm-hmm.
and here's the value that we'll get. These are the things that we'll have to do. And we tell pretty good stories. We've got some great writers. Some of the industry visionaries have written with us, Peggy Miles, Dan Rayburn, Steve Mack, and Ben Wagoner. We have really good quality content, and we have a great staff that's committed to making sure it gets out there every month.
Certainly, it seems like one of the biggest and hottest areas for streaming media right now is in the corporate environment, and it seems like that's really the backbone of the industry right now. Are you seeing other elements of the streaming industry starting to develop and grow?
I concur with you entirely. I break it down in three ways. I talk about it. The whole industry from the standpoint of the three E's. There's the enterprise piece, the education piece, and the entertainment piece.
Mm-hmm.
At the very outset of streaming, the entertainment piece got all of the news. It was on the front page of the journal. There was all of that entertainment stuff. And then, of course, the CARP put a little bit of a stinger on internet radio, and there's the MPAA and the threat against iFilms and those types of sides of the world that have really stymied the growth of that part right now.
Yeah.
I believe that'll be ameliorated sometime in 2003, 2004. And companies are going to start building business models around which they can profit and provide terrific services for consumers. I look at the education and the enterprise space as being interestingly parallel. The enterprise space, they have the money to invest, and they have the easiest to see upside for that investment. For example, mm-hmm. reduction in cost for human resources, training for corporate communication, or mm-hmm. a better connection with your investors when you have your quarterly calls. Light bulb moment, I get it, I want to buy it. The thing of it is, folks in the education sector who aren't as well-funded and can't necessarily say, snap your finger and you're going to make the investment, they're the ones, I think, who kind of, quote, get it a little bit better mm-hmm. than the executives right now. I mean, that's, in my experience, like there's folks at Eastern Tennessee State University, Seton Hall University, Duke, MIT. There's an array of very high-profile colleges and K-12 environments, actually, New York City school systems. They're all leveraging the streaming technology to help, you know, to educate students better, mm-hmm. connect students from around the globe better. However, they don't have the capital really to go crazy, hog wild, and invest in the environment. There's a great example in the July issue of streaming for the corporate space. Actually, several. Almost every month we have one. But I happen to have in front of me the Cisco infrastructure investment article. And they threw down somewhere in the general neighborhood of $8 million to create a very, very impressive studio down in San Jose that I had visited back in, I think, April or May.
Mm.
And it was an enormous outlay in cash. However, in the first 12 months of operation, they made it all back.
Wow.
Exactly. Wow.
So were they actually saving money, or are they generating some sort of revenue from that?
No, they're actually saving money now. They're moving forward with a strategy that anyone within the Cisco enterprise who wants to leverage their studios If you need to do a training video, you need to do something, say, for example, a competitive product comes out, you can have one executive zip on over to San Jose or across the campus, actually, record a video on demand, instructional piece for the sales crew, for the marketing people, for the technology folks, and say, okay, now you go out and access this on your time, and you'll be advised so that when you have that conversation, say, for example, from a sales standpoint, something to say in response to that new competitive product. Very quick, very simple, very easy, and very, very smart.
No doubt in my mind that we can save a lot using streaming media within business. And I know you kind of touched on the consumer / entertainment area, but let's not scare our listeners into thinking they need to, you know, invest $8 million to stream something. So why don't you address what maybe on the consumer level they can do if they want to do something in with streaming?
From a consumer standpoint, say, for example, you want to do a show to your family, for your family, from your living room. There are a series of really nifty products out there that are priced in the hundreds of dollars ranges. Now, naturally, you'll need to have a video camera and some infrastructure, computer infrastructure. Now, I'm not going to count that those costs because I'm assuming that you've already covered that. But the encoding software and the equipment with which you need to do the process can be very low cost for a consumer. Now, obviously, you're not streaming, you know, to hundreds of people at the same time. You don't have major server issues. It can be done very inexpensively, and for small businesses as well. Here's an example. An example of a guy that I talked with just around this time last year. He's a horse farmer. He breeds and sells horses. And what he decided to do was do a video on demand on his website for interested buyers of his horses. Because you can describe a horse and show a picture of a horse all you like, but if you don't see the horse running around in circles and you can't fly to Kentucky or wherever the heck the guy was, then you know, you're less likely to be inclined to say, yeah, it's the animal I want to purchase. Yeah. So he was very smart. He just had his own little video camera. He got a capture card. He put the thing together in his home office. And from the ranch, he's got the ability to connect with more customers. He's not a worldwide enterprise, but someday maybe he could be, or at least that's the example for a horse breeder that wants to go crazy and say, you know, I'm going to have full-on 24/7 videos of my stable.
Yeah, it certainly seems like that the opportunities for streaming media in the future are vast and broad, but it also seems like what's been holding it back is broadband. But in a lot of ways, that's not really true either, but it's a perception that's out there. You know, I mean, there's streams that are like 20K that can go over a 28.8 connection, but it still seems like people perceive streaming media as a broadband application. What's your thoughts on that?
I think you're right. It is a perception problem. We have now a great amount of broadband. I wouldn't say it's a glut, but it's getting close. There's an awful lot of pipe out there that's really being underutilized. Now we have networks with which we're leveraging peer-to-peer, and that greatly reduces the constraints that are presented by the bandwidth. So I think the final thing is that it's a public perception that if you have lower bandwidth, you know, like a 56 or lower connection, you're dealing with only like an AM-style sound as opposed to a, you know, an FM-style. It's the comparison I tend to make, having been part of radio for a little while. I think something that will be ameliorated will be solved pretty quickly because of the growth of broadband. I think I saw a statistic recently that 50% of American homes have at least access with a broadband connection. They need to improve, but then again, so did wireless technology when cell phones first appeared. When the services became that reliable and essentially bulletproof and high quality, cell phones took off. Well, guess what? That's exactly what's going to happen with consumer adoption of things like, for example, satellite radio, which is, you know, one of the technologies we're looking at as well.
We're speaking with Doug Wiley, editor of Streaming Magazine. More with Doug in a moment. This is Web Talk Guys Radio.
You're still connected to the Web Talk Guys Radio show. I'm Rob Greenlee, and Web Girl Dana's here.
We have Streaming Magazine editor Doug Wiley on the phone. He's talking with us about how streaming media can help business.
Yeah, it certainly seems like we've been through kind of a boom and a bust cycle, and that streaming media is probably at its lowest point from a perception standpoint, but it really seems like it's starting to climb back in people's value perceptions. So are you seeing the same thing?
I think that while some people may now see that the streaming media space is kind of at its lowest level, I feel that that may have actually happened some number of months ago. I think that we've been on an upswing low. It's not a hockey stick, but it has been a little bit progression day after day in terms of heightening the value perception about streaming media. And again, that's happening in the corporate environment pretty easily because executives who are looking to reduce costs and add to the bottom line can see very easily the fact that streaming can help to reduce your costs for communications, that can help to increase or enhance your connection with the consumer. I like to point to news and sports as two really great, compelling sources of content that don't have copyright issues, or when they do, it's with a league and not with, say, the MPAA or the RIAA.
That's true.
And those leagues have a vested interest in enhancing their connection with the fan. The word fan comes from fancier or fanatic. Mm-hmm. Those people are crazy. I happen to be one of them. And if you have the ability to stream the audio signal of a baseball game from the East Coast while you're sitting in your office and check out a couple of scores while you're at it, that is stunningly compelling.
Yeah.
And the ability for, say, for example, the CNN subscription for the video on demand, they're building a business around that. And the opportunity for not only to have a greater, a better informed public, and a better connection, by the way, brand-wise from CNN to the consuming public, but also CNN is potentially, now they haven't said this to me, potentially going to stand to make money on that offering.
Mm-hmm.
And they're building advertising into it, and they're, you know, it's evolving. And while some, I guess, would say that we've kind of reached this little bottom of the trough, I think that we've really done that some time ago, and we're really stepping it up in the last 6-8 months, and I think in the next 12, I think we're really going to see an enormous explosion in the popularity of the technology.
Seems like we have more of a natural growth curve right now.
Yeah, the hype is over.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, when I joined the magazine just about a year ago, that ooh-ah element to the whole thing had completely died.
Mm-hmm.
And that element had kind of seen its way into the pages of the magazine. You know, golly gee whiz. Now, at that point, I came on at a very lucky time because my philosophy is to say, whatever. Tell me what this is going to do for me.
That's right. And it's a more practical perspective.
Exactly.
Right? It's the same thing that happened with the dot-coms. There was over expectations on what it could do with the current audience that it had, but that doesn't mean that it didn't potentially have huge implications.
Exactly.
In the October issue of Streaming Magazine, you named the 50 most influential people of 2002. So obviously there are people, there are industry leaders out there that are making a difference. Could you run down a few of your favorites?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that my thumbprint really appeared in this particular issue. The number one I named was James Billington. And I had a whole editorial team working with me. Librarian of Congress James Billington was really, I think, the most influential in the entertainment sector because he was the guy who presided over the CARP proceeding. I wanted to choose what many in the industry would perceive as a black hat because I think that the timing was right. Mm-hmm. I think that it was the most honest thing to say. I think that someone in Streaming Magazine is obviously the place where that type of a conversation is going to happen, had to stand up and say, "This, what happened is not right, and we need to correct it."
Sure.
Of course, among the others, we've got, you know, Rob Glazer. They put out the Helix server and community this year. I think that was large. WM9 from Microsoft, so there's a couple of guys from Microsoft on there. Then, of course, there's some of the thought leaders that have been around for a while. Like I mentioned a couple of names before. There's Peggy Miles and Dan Rayburn, who are friends of mine and friends of the magazine. But also, more than that, they've really done a lot to help push the industry down the road. A couple of newcomers. We had Christy Hefner, who errantly was listed as working for Major League Baseball in the magazine, for which I horribly apologize. But in her group has built a terrific business around some of their streamed content.
And why don't you clarify Christy Hefner?
Christy Hefner from Playboy.
That's right.
She's the CEO of Playboy.
Sex and sports.
Yeah, sex and sports. Well, gee, I know there's an awful lot of money that goes into those things on the internet anyway.
Yeah.
Or Sawyer from Sawyer Media System, who's taken an interesting philosophy of his manner in which he reports news and creates news stories, and taken that to the corporate environment and instructed them and informed them how they can have better quality communication. The folks in the magazine that are on the 50 most this year, each person has done an enormous amount. I do encourage anyone who wants it to send a note to me, Doug at Streaming Magazine, or to Joel, Joel at StreamingMag.com. Then we will either be able to get you a PDF or some sort of a copy of it or what have you, because it's been an invaluable resource just for people interested in the streaming business. Now, talking about further about invaluable resources and special issues, I did want to make sure I mentioned the Reader's Choice Award. The readers that select the most important software, hardware, services, and people. Soon enough, that'll be on our website, streamingmagazine.com, the ability to send us your input. Then we'll announce the winners of the Reader's Choice 2003, as we normally do at the NAB in Las Vegas.
And that would be in the April issue.
April. Yeah. April. It's the April issue, yeah, I believe.
We need to take a quick break, but more with Doug Wiley and Streaming Magazine on the other side. This is Web Talk Guys Radio.
Web Web Talk Radio is back. I'm Rob Greenlee, and I'm here with Web Girl Dana.
And with us today is Doug Wiley. He's the editor of Streaming Magazine.
What are some of the hottest areas right now for streaming? What things are we going to see in the next 18 months?
For one, I think that MPEG-4 is going to become real. It's been lurking in the background there for a couple of, it seems like forever, but it's I guess, no more than about mm-hmm. 2 years. My sense and my finger in the wind says it's going to increase its visibility. It's because there's some applications that really start being used with it. You're always going to have new development from Microsoft and from Real. Those two, in battling each other, are helping to drive the industry further down the road. And the Helix community, Helix server, and Helix platform are an interesting open source possibility. I'm not certain it's really going to go hog wild right away, but I think it's a really neat development. From the standpoint of who's going to adopt it and where it's going to start really coming up and getting greater national media, for example, I think that you'll wind up seeing CNN stories about a company in some part of the country that did something interesting. In the November issue, the government issue, I reported on two things that I thought were really rather neat. The United States Senate has deployed streaming so that they can easily search their databases and the metadata that's associated with all of the video and supply staffers in a timely way with information from the floor and the debates of the Senate. Now, that's an enormous volume of information that they had to pour over by hand before. Gee, you're going to make the government more efficient? Thank you. And then there was another story about the U.S. Navy testing facilities that they're using an ATM network and streams over that network so that people in Patuxent, Maryland can see weapons testing here in California. Well, with a possible war looming in the next few months, that is an interesting and compelling use of the technology to lower costs and have a greater efficiency. I'm encouraged about the whole industry, and I'm hopeful that I'll be the lucky guy to stand on the sidelines and have a notebook in my hand to watch those new things that we haven't yet dreamt up.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background, Doug? When did you start with Streaming Magazine?
I started with Streaming Magazine on the 3rd of March. Mm-hmm. Immediately prior to that, I had worked with a trade magazine called Gavin. That was a radio trade magazine that's been around for about 44 or so years. And I had reported on streaming technologies and other technologies as they relate to radio.
Mm-hmm.
My background really is kind of peppered with some very odd jobs. Just coming out of University of Maryland, I wanted to be a rock star. And so I did that for a few years and determined that I wasn't talented enough to actually become a rock star.
What was the name of your band?
The name of the band was Giant Killer.
Oh, cool.
And we were a three-piece of some local note in Washington, D.C. But because of that kind of background in music and entertainment, that's how I kind of wound up being a reporter in the entertainment space initially. And then mm-hmm. I started working on technology. And I frequently joke that I write about code. I don't write code. I'm a linguist, not a programmer. From that standpoint, I think it's also helpful for our magazine because I when I talk with a technologist, I demand that it get to be, if I can understand it, then for sure my readers want. And so, you know, that's essentially my background. I live in San Francisco.
The magazine is actually based in...
The magazine is based in West Palm Beach, Florida, where we have our main corporate offices.
Mm-hmm.
And there you'll find administrative, the financial, the art department, and our other colleagues from Radio Inc. as well. And our associate publisher, Joel Unico, is in a place in north of Vancouver in Canada. Happily, he's on the same coast as me, so we maintain roughly the same business hours because we're in contact with each other half a dozen to a dozen times a day.
Why don't you just recap in the last few minutes we have the information about how people can get the buyer's guide, where your website is, and subscription information for the magazine?
Yeah, I'd be really happy to do that. You can subscribe to the magazine. You can get the buyer's guide. You can read daily news updates. You can check out some past features from the magazine. You can send press releases to me at streamingmagazine.com. You know, the magazine itself, the buyer's guide, which has just come out, is available there. The cost for the buyer's guide is $9.99 for domestic and $15.95 for international purchasers. The buyer's guide itself, a pretty hefty book. It's 72 pages long, and it's filled with things like Digital Media 101, an introduction to MPEG-4, which we believe is probably going to have some sizzle in the steak over the course of the next 12 months. And importantly, it's just a resource, a desktop resource that's supposed to have a 12-month shelf life until we do another one in 2004. It's got a full dictionary, a rather glossary, so that an executive who hears a term over the phone can just quickly look it up and say, oh, I know what that is now. There are listings and some explanations of some kind of standard important things, like encoding or things like that, you know, where you'll get a great deal of information from that. You know, the website, again, is going to have the ability for our readers to submit their choices for the 2003 Reader's Choice Award, which will appear in April and will be announced and broadcast from the floor of the trade show at NAB in Las Vegas. I believe that's in middle April.
Mm-hmm.
And we do a weekly email newsletter in which you'll get a recap of the week's news.
Doug, it was great having you on the show with us.
Rob, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Doug Wiley, who's the managing editor of StreamingMagazine.com. And go check out their publication online and off. Have a great weekend, Doug.
Thanks a lot, Rob. Dana, have a great one.
Stay connected because we'll take an even closer look at media on the Internet with Rob Coonan. He's president of the MPEG-4 Industry Forum. On the other side of the break, our WebTalkGuy colleague and host of the streaming media show, Dan Rayburn, will go deep into the latest developments in MPEG-4 with a guy who played a key role in the development of the MPEG-4 standard. This is WebTalkGuy's Radio.
Hey, you're a website guru, right?
Yes, I am.
Well, what do you think about audio in the web world?
I think audio and websites are definitely the wave of the future. In this time of high technology, any website with audio on it is a sticky website, a site that's hard to leave once you have gotten there.
I see. It's kind of like listening to a song on the radio and then watching the video. There's a big difference.
Exactly. Instead of having to read the website, the site is read to you. It's a lot easier to learn about the site's product or service. The possibilities are endless, really. Let's say you're a coffee vendor and you have a website. Beside each different coffee drink listed, you can have an audio clip telling you the ingredients of the drink, the quantity, and the cost. Now that's user-friendly.
Loudbox Productions does just that. We are your web-enabled audio specialists. Contact us at loudbox.com. Let us help you tunnel your way into the future.
You're listening to the Streaming Media Show on the WebTalk Guys Network. I'm your host, Dan Rayburn, and today we're talking with Rob Coonan. Rob is president of the MPEG-4 industry, and we're talking about the latest developments in MPEG-4. Rob, thanks for joining us today on the Streaming Media Show.
Welcome, Dan. It's good to be here.
What we're going to be talking about today with you, obviously, is MPEG-4 and all the latest and greatest developments with it. Why don't you start off a little bit by telling us you are the president of the MPEG-4 Industry Forum. Why don't you tell us a little bit what that forum is?
Okay, so the MPEG-4 Industry Forum is not MPEG itself. The MPEG-4 Industry Forum is a group of about 100 companies and institutions that want to see the MPEG-4 standard adopted. The main reason for having the industry forum is that there's a lot of things that you want to do to get a standard widely adopted that you can't really address in a standardization forum. And there's also quite a few parties that want to get the standard adopted that don't necessarily have to be involved in setting the standard itself. So there's some other members between MPEG and the MPEG-4 industry forum.
Okay, so what we're talking about here then is the standard of MPEG-4. Can you really give us a brief background for listeners who don't really know about the technology? What exactly is MPEG-4? We hear a lot about MPEG-1 and MPEG-2 and a little bit about MPEG-3, but MPEG-4 certainly lately has been really the hot topic. What exactly is it?
MPEG-3 is an interesting one because it actually doesn't exist. MPEG-3 is MPEG-1 or MPEG-2 layer 3 audio. And so MPEG-4 is really the successor of MPEG-2. MPEG-1, MPEG-2, MPEG-4, but it isn't intended to replace MPEG-2. Let me say that up front. So what is MPEG-4? It's an architecture and representation methods for multimedia content. And we often like to say it's object-based, which means you can compose what we call a scene. And I'm throwing in quite a bit of terminology here, but I'll explain everything. But you have a scene that is can be composed of a number of objects. The objects can be a video, they can be text, they can be graphics, they can be also sounds, either computer generated or recorded with a microphone. So that is MPEG-4 in its most complete incarnation, I would say. In its simplest incarnation, it's simply interoperable streaming of just rectangular video and stereo sound.
Okay, so now why is that such a big deal when it comes to streaming media? I mean, right now we're obviously using MPEG-1 and MPEG-2 and some MPEG-3. Why is MPEG-4 such an advancement and such new technology that everybody's talking about?
MPEG-2 is widely used in TV systems, but it doesn't really go down to the bit rates that you need for streaming and for mobile use. MPEG-1 does go down in bit rate, but doesn't really address mobile use either and the really low bit rate. So MPEG-4 was designed to be across the whole range of bit rates from really 10 kilobits per second, you could say, to really high quality.
Okay.
What is a big thing about it is that it does allow interoperable streaming, which means that if you have an MP4 file with just simple audio and video, you can play it in a QuickTime player, you can play it in a Real player now, which is something that until quite recently, we had three different formats, QuickTime and Real and Microsoft.
So really what you're saying is MPEG-4 could be the first time that the industry's had an actual standard.
I guess that for the streaming industry, that's definitely the case.
Okay. So when people are thinking about MPEG-4, because a lot of the questions I get are, what is the latest and greatest with MPEG-4? And also, should I be thinking about putting my content in an MPEG-4 format? And how do you really answer that for somebody?
The latest and greatest about MPEG-4 is that it does allow you to do interoperable streaming, and it does do quite a bit more. Also, if you want to do real interactivity, MPEG-4 has great support for interactivity. But let's start with interoperable streaming. That's a great thing. Should you put your content in MPEG-4? By all means, I think you should. And I think we see people doing just that, and I think QuickTime leads the way there.
But now, if you're a corporation and you're already putting your content in different formats, a lot of people are viewing it as, okay, now MPEG-4 is just another format I have to put my content into.
At the moment, it may be seen as just another format, but the promise is that you will only have to put it in MPEG-4 instead of also in MPEG-4.
So what's really stopping the industry from pushing forward and say MPEG-4 is going to be the de facto standard for content creation?
Okay, there's a couple of things right now. The tools are becoming available. It has taken some time, but they're there now. And interestingly, you see a lot of encoding providers really trying to beat each other, which means that MPEG-4 quality is really increasing rapidly at the moment. That's one thing. The second thing is that up until now, the licensing situation was unclear. The license has now been published for MPEG-4 video, at least. That's been published by a group of companies that hold essential patents in MPEG-4. And it's really a private institution, I would almost say, a private company that does this. Some people think it's MPEG that publishes these licensees, and some people think it's M4AF, but it's neither. We do discuss licensing in M4AF, but it's basically published by a consortium that consists of all the people that have essential patents in such a standard. And essential patent is a patent that you cannot avoid if you to implement.
And they've
the
recently
standard.
Just put out licensing on using that patent.
Yes.
And how exactly does that licensing work? Because I know there has been a lot of talk in the industry lately about it's been a little bit confusing. Has that all been straightened out?
It's been confusing. I don't think it's all been straightened out yet because one of the things, they've defined a number of usage areas. There's still some confusion over what fits into which usage area. I think for a number of usage areas, the thing is clear now. If you want to do a broadcast to a set-top box, for instance, or if you're a company and you want to make available your corporate videos, then everything is clear. Where there's still a little bit of confusion is if you have to pay in some cases, you need to pay a use fee, and how that use fee plays out. We've done some math, and it's depending on how you see it. It's a part of the cost of streaming. It doesn't need to be a large part of that cost because there's just a lot of cost involved if you want to make available streaming content.
Sure.
But exactly how the use fee plays out, that all still needs to it needs to become clear. And there's a lot of conversation going on right now. Between different potential users and the MPEG-LA who administers the license. And we're getting more and more information. Recently, the license was published, so people can take a look for themselves now.
Okay, so when corporations are, and also just the industry, is looking at this new technology, one thing that I certainly get asked a lot, and I definitely believe, is the new technology is not what always gets adopted. So we have that instance with the beta and the VHS player. People adopted VHS, but beta was better. What is it about MPEG-4 that you feel that people are actually going to adopt it and the newest and greatest technology is going to be adopted by the masses? What is it going to take for MPEG-4 to be a mainstream default
okay.
standard, because a lot of people, when they talk about quality, you know, quality in the streaming media space, everybody defines differently. They define it based on sometimes just the quality of the audio and video stream, but people also base quality based on parameters such as the quality of the audio and video stream, but also what is the service cost, how good is customer service, how flexible is it. There's a lot of options.
The main important things with MPEG-4 is that it's a standard that goes across industries. And what you see today is being adopted in streaming media platforms for the PC, but also people are putting it in DVD players, and it's also being used a lot in the mobile space, in 3G phones and services. And MPEG-4 is really the only technology that allows you to go across all these platforms with a single format.
So it's a multiple application format.
And a single architecture. And you could compare it a little bit with MP3. That's actually allowed the same kind of thing for just music or for audio. And what you see today, MP3 is an old standard that dates back to 1992, and it's not even the most efficient coding standard anymore for audio by a long stretch, but it's still being integrated into car stereos and DVD players and CD players, and it's still widely supported in internet music players. So the value of a standard goes across platforms, and that allows people to move content across platforms apparently is quite large. And I think MPEG-4 holds that same promise for audio-visual multimedia material. And that's actually what I see happening if I look at all the developments, and I keep a very close watch of all the MPEG-4 news. I see more and more news about MPEG-4 being integrated into handheld devices, into mobile phones, in PDAs, in DVD players, into some of the set-top boxes that are being manufactured right now.
Right, right. And I know that NTT Docomo just announced that they were going to a MPEG-4 format. Now, how does that affect the current players out there in the technology space like Microsoft, Apple, and Real Networks?
Apple and Real Networks, in fact, already support both. NTT Docomo has announced is basically the wrapping format that's changing. I think they used to use advanced streaming format, but they're now shifting towards MP4, which is the standardized file format that MPEG-4 uses. You could encode your video and your audio in an interoperable way, but then if you still pack it in a way that's only understood on part of the platforms, then you still are not interoperable. So what this means is that it's becoming easier to exchange content across platforms because it's that same MP4 file format that is also used in other devices and other platforms.
So it's really the one platform and application that you can deliver to any device out there capable of receiving it.
That's the ultimate promise. Yes.
And when we're talking about that, obviously a lot of what we're seeing to multiple devices now is audio content.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that just recently we're talking about high-efficiency AAC with the MPEG-4, mm-hmm. and that the new format does CD-quality stereo at 48 kilobits.
That's correct.
So let's talk a little bit about that. First and foremost, how is it able to do that? And second, how does that factor of being able to do better quality at a lower bit rate really affect the business model for this taking off?
Okay, so first let's take a look at how it works, and I will tell you what I understand of it. That's only a limited understanding because I'm not an audio coder. What spectral bandwidth replication does, and that's the technology that underpins high efficiency AAC, is it kind of splits the spectrum in half, and then it protects the upper half of the spectrum from the lower half. And then it gives you some extra information to make that prediction more accurate. But that really gives you an enormous saving in bandwidth, and it's actually surprised many of the people that have done audio coding for years what this technology is able to give you.
We're having a conversation with Rob Coonan, president of the MPEG-4 Industry Forum, about latest developments in MPEG-4. More in a moment. This is the Web Talk Guys Network. You're listening to the Streaming Media Show on the Web Talk Guys Network. I'm your host, Dan Rayburn, and today we're talking with Rob Coonan. Rob is president of the MPEG-4 industry. We're talking about the latest developments in MPEG-4. Now, I know when we were talking about the interoperability of MPEG-4, I know that I've been asked a lot of times from folks, and maybe you can clear this up, that if they encode with a company, say Company X, to do with the encoding, and Company Y's player won't actually play the content?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it used to be that way indeed. And this is why, as one of the most important activities in the MP4 industry forum, we've said we need extended product interoperability tests. So we have an interoperability program, which we have now a total, I think, of 30 to 35 companies that all exchange their bit streams. And these are the bit streams that come from actual products that they're making.
So as president of the MPEG-4 Industry Forum, really, what is it that the Industry Forum is trying to do out there? Is it more of an education process, or is it more, let's try and put all these companies together and make sure it's a true interoperability format?
All of the above and more. We are trying to do all the things that are necessary to get MPEG-4 adopted. One of the interoperability you just mentioned, it is crucial because we get a lot of questions and we need to be able to answer these questions. Telling people what MPEG-4 is crucially important. So we have a lot of marketing activities. We're at a lot of trade shows and conferences. Licensing at some point, especially when we started, was the major hurdle. So we spent a lot of time discussing the issues and discussing what licensing models could be useful for MPEG-4. And ultimately, we don't want to deal with licensing ourselves. That is not our task. But we did want to do the things that were necessary to break the logjam.
And where's the best place for people to go on the web that really, truly describes the licensing terms for all the components?
I think you should go to the M4F website, and then we have in the About MPEG-4 section, we have a collection of links. We have a special section on patents and licensing.
And what's the URL of your website?
It's www.m4if.org.
Great. So what are some of the advantages of getting people to come up and sign up for your organization, the members you have?
Oh, if you allow me to do a membership pitch, we're really a low threat.
Well, I think it's definitely of value to people who are in that industry really trying to work to make this a format. So if you're offering something that is definitely a low-cost solution for people to be able to get their hands on not only tools but licensing information, and also based on the over 100 members you have here, I mean, there's certainly some substantial members with Apple and AOL, Time Warner, and AT&T.
Uh-huh. The value of our members, some of the value we, by the way, give to the whole community. Information about licensing we would not want to keep for ourselves. But there are other things like the interop program that are for our members. We do a lot of the trade show stuff that we allow our members to go to trade shows together with us, or to give them a lot of speaking opportunities. Of course, it's a value in itself to be able to meet a lot of other parts of industry who can often be your industry partners, because I've seen a lot of networking going on at our meetings. You get a chance to discuss directly with the licensors, because many of them are members, and also their representatives are members. And all of this, we try to keep the cost really low. It's $3,000 a year, so. And actually, if you join after the 1st of January, it's only $2,000 for the rest of the fiscal year, which runs until July. So we try to do a lot of the things, give a lot of values to our members without having them pay a lot of money for the membership.
Okay. Now, we're running out of time here, Rob, but what I want to do is I want you to leave people with what you feel is the most important misconception about MPEG-4, because there's certainly a lot of talk about it, and I see a lot of articles on it, and certainly licensing was one of the big issues that people still didn't understand, but what is the one biggest misconception that you really want to correct with people about MPEG-4?
There are a few, actually. The oldest is surely that MPEG-4 is a low bitrate video codec. The second oldest is you need to segment MPEG-4 in your video before you can use it because it's object-based. I think these are the most common ones. What I would like to stress is that MPEG-4 is really a framework, and it includes audio coding and video coding. It includes the interactivity, it includes the file format. It includes a lot of things, and you can make it as complicated as you want, but you can also make it as simple as you want. And that's maybe the third misconception, that is, you need to have enormously complex machines and software to be able to do MPEG-4. But there are really quite simple forms of MPEG-4. Just doing interoperable streaming is in itself quite an accomplishment, and it can be done in a simple way.
Well, great. Rob, I'd like to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity, Dan. It's a pleasure.
And for more information, you can visit www.m4if.org.
That's correct.
Rob, thanks for joining us today.
Welcome, Dan.
I'm your host, Dan Rayburn, on the Web Talk Guys Network.
Thank you for downloading the Web Talk Guys. Bookmark us now for next week. Same Web Talk Guys time, same Web Talk Guys channel.